Hello, everyone. Thank you for staying late into the day. And thank you, Nida, for the invitation, and Ansem also, and the introduction. Let me find my text here. Okay. So the research I'm presenting this evening is based in large part on my time spent in the archive of Abby Weed Gray, who is a figure I will introduce shortly. It also comes out of my interest in abstraction in the Cold War period and how the question of abstraction and figuration as this sort of false binary is negotiated from the perspective of artists living and working in what we call the Middle East. I think this is an incredibly rich topic that we've only just now started to scratch the surface. And it speaks to another sort of familiar blind spot in art history, which is how does the non-Western world fit into this, relate to this now canonized history of Cold War art and politics. The history of art as soft power is the history of the internationalization of art through institutions, through legal parameters, and through exhibitions, etc. That history can be traced to the context of World War I, if you might be able to go earlier. I tend to think of it as sort of coming, coalescing in World War I around the funny sort of the odd initiative to present a canon, namely usually the French canon of art, via reproductions. And I'm fascinated by the way in which reproductions of art take on a life of their own in this period and are so central to how, the international art world as such gets constituted. The sort of taking over from after World War I, you have the League of Nations and some really concrete steps to institutionalize this idea of the international in art. And of course, as we know, the ancestors it's UNESCO and ICOM, et cetera, that take on that mantle after World War II. I'm addressing today a collector and her foundation who is American, and there are some differences, I think, worth pointing out in her approach in terms of when she enters this field of the international. One, as we'll see over and over again, is that it's the individual. It's framed as a relationship between individuals, people to people, rather than states to states or collectives to collectives. The individual is the site of communication, exchange, etc. Abby Weed Gray was also adamant that it be original works of art that travel, not reproductions, which I think is not without precedent, of course, but is very important in sort of tracing this narrative of internationalization. So in this period, you have, as people have noted, this false binary of abstraction, realism, communism, democracy. The question remains, how do artists in most of the rest of the world, areas that are, countries that are either non-aligned or artists that are looking for a third term, a third world sort of sense of collectivity, how they would negotiate this binary that's presented to them as such. And I would argue that the negotiation or adoption of one or other of these elements of abstraction or figuration is approached by many of these artists in many different ways as strategic. And so they're not only looking towards the dominant sort of Cold War conflict and its binary, but they're also speaking multiple languages because they're speaking to their own local audiences, they're speaking regionally, they're speaking to, you know, third spaces and third collectivities. All of this makes for a very complex but also rich and nuanced history that, as I said, I think we're only beginning to scratch the surface of. So I want to back up and say it's wonderful to be here, not only as an art historian with a particular interest in this period and these issues, but also in a sense, due to my job title, as a representative of the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. The Met plays a bit role in this history of Cold War parapolitics, but an interesting one. And here I must thank the technical assistant who spoke yesterday on behalf of the Museum of Modern Art in America for his discussion of this key sort of moment in the history of American art in the Cold War. And you might recognize this was a work by that was included in an exhibition called Advancing American Art, and which was a particular point of a sort of drew a special amount of attention and say negative attention when politicians turned against the exhibition. So the exhibition opened at the Met in October 1946. The show featured paintings and watercolors by 45 American artists acquired by former Walker Art Center curator Leroy Davidson using U.S. State Department funds. Despite the exhibition's critical success in New York and later outside of the U.S., Republican members of Congress, perhaps hoping to capitalize on the news of a state-funded art collection, denounced the collection, the exhibition, the art, and modern art tout court as politically and aesthetically suspect, leading ultimately to a disassembling of the collection at the auction house as surplus property by the War Assets Administration in 1948, at a loss of some $50,000. Artists whose work were included, such as Stuart Davis, Romare Bearden, Ben Shahn, George O'Keefe, Jacob Lawrence, Marsden Hartley, and others, were denounced for their modernism and sometimes their abstraction of their work. Members of Congress put this work on trial as un-American and would later put some of the artists involved on trial for being un-American as well. The political fallout from Advancing American Art lends some color, I think, to the policy shift moving forward towards burying state involvement in promoting art and cultural events. After 1946, public attention, both domestically and internationally, would be drawn instead to a host of initiatives organized by private individuals and institutions. In the late 1950s, Abby Weed Gray was searching for a new path. Her husband had passed away in 1956, leaving her unexpectedly wealthy. After a 2.5-month trip that took her to India, Iran, and Pakistan, among other places, she founded the Ben and Abby Gray Foundation in 1962 with the aim of promoting artistic exchange between the U.S. and the rest of the world and promoting American art abroad. Gray and her foundation adhered to an understanding of art as a universal language. This is an image of the exhibition hall of an exhibition organized by the foundation called Communication Through Art in the early 60s in Lahore. in a letter addressed to His Excellency Mr. M. Palbod, brother-in-law to the Shah of Iran, Gray assures him that a touring exhibition of contemporary Iranian artists organized by the foundation in 1962, quote, will continue to make friends for Iran through that language that is a universal means of communication, the language of art, unquote. This language was to be a conversation, that is, a back and forth between cultures and nations carried out, we should emphasize, by individuals. In an article dedicated to the same exhibition in Minneapolis, she is quoted as saying, I think we've shown you how private means and individual work can help to understand cultural exchange. In case you are wondering if the lady doth protest too much, she does, continuing, it shows that what citizens can do without help from the government. This assertion, of course, only makes sense if one discounts the funding and organizational support consistently provided the foundation by the United States Information Agency and later the Smithsonian Institute from its earliest touring exhibitions of the 1960s, such as this one, to its involvement with the American Pavilion at the first and second Triennales of Contemporary World Art held in New Delhi in 1968 and 71, respectively. Other familiar collaborators, and there were many, and I think something that tends to fall between the cracks in these discussions is the recognition of, you know, this is not entirely a unidirectional process. There are institutions in many of these countries that an American foundation like the Gray Foundation were trying to reach that were collaborators and partners, some of them also funded by the U.S. State Department, others not. But others, in the case of Iran, which is going to be my sort of test case for what I'm discussing today, she worked with the Iran-American Society, which was sponsored by the USIS, American Friends of the Middle East, the State Department American Specialist Program, as well as the Fine Arts Administration of Iran. Gray's involvement in all of this, of course, can't be reduced to the role of frontman. The foundation emerged out of her own interests and appetites as a collector and her passion for contemporary art, as well as for the, quote, working artist, the creative person wrestling with concepts, values, and problems which are part of the contemporary scene, unquote. Ultimately, she would amass a collection of over 1,000 works with special concentrations in contemporary art from Iran, India, and Turkey. At the same time, key elements of the foundation's approach resonate clearly with what is, at this point, might be characterized as the established tenets of the State Department's involvement with the arts as cultural propaganda, as well as following the broader contours of American foreign policy in the Middle East and South Asia. It's worth pointing to three specific areas of overlap in this regard. So Leroy Davidson, whose concerted effort in amassing a collection of American art on behalf of the State Department and culminated in the Advancing American Art debacle, described a rather circumscribed group as his preferred target audience for exhibitions of American art abroad. This was not, he quoted, not, quote, a mass program, he stated, but, quote, a medium. Medium is a word I'll return to shortly. Directed toward small but powerful segments of opinion-forming groups, unquote. Similarly, the Gray Foundation's first progress report stated a preference for a directed rather than scattershot approach, quote, deciding that emphasis should be aimed at the serious student and professional rather than the general public. The Gray Foundation courted small-scale venues, and especially university galleries, both in the U.S. and abroad. The approach was a canny one and foretells the success garnered today, for example, by an institution such as the Bargil Foundation, which has pursued a similar strategy in promoting modern Arab art on the international stage. As can be seen, wrote Abby Gray, the exhibitions prepared on a small scale were not meant to be spectacular. They were anything but an end in themselves. They were a means of communication, a line of connection, a highway, channel, or passage. The Gray Foundation's shifting geographic purview, and here's the second catalog of the Biennale, Triennale in India. Here's a photograph of the American Pavilion at the Triennale, which the Gray Foundation helped realize. Let me skip ahead. Okay, so the Gray Foundation's shifting geographic purview from 1961 to 1967 was Iran, Turkey, and Pakistan figured centrally in foundation initiatives. Works from all three countries were exhibited widely at U.S. and international venues. Likewise, exhibitions of American art were traveled around all three countries. Notably, the fifth and last Tehran Biennale adopted a regional focus. That's the years 1966, limiting participants to artists from Turkey and Pakistan, and Iran, of course, its partners in the Regional Cooperation for Development, or RCD. The RCD, in turn, had been established 2 years prior under the auspices of CENTO, or the Central Treaty Organization, a military agreement dating to 1955. Known initially as the Baghdad Pact, its original signatories included Iran, Turkey, and Pakistan, as well as Iraq and the UK. Iraq withdrew from the pact in 1959, following the coup a year prior, and the US joined what would now be called CENTO as an associate member. One of the initial aims of the pact had been to check Soviet ambitions in the region. Ties between India and the USSR grew stronger in the late 50s and early 60s in response to US and Chinese interests in Pakistan. In Egypt, Pan-Arabist leader Gamal Abdel Nasser cultivated Soviet support. However, Abi Gray made three collection and research trips to India in 1964, 65, and 68. And the Gray Foundation's public focus shifted to India between 67 and 71. Bookending Gray's involvement with India were two major military conflicts. On the one hand, the 1962 Sino-India border war, which drew Pakistan and China closer together and elicited US support for India. On the other, the 1971 war between India and Pakistan, which led to the creation of Bangladesh and the establishment of the 20-year Treaty of Friendship and Cooperation between India and the Soviet Union. This is a map showing Abi Gray has marked all the sites she's visited beginning in 1960. I haven't yet come across any explicit mention in the Gray archives of a deliberate alignment of foundation planning and the State Department's shifting allegiances in the region. Neither have I seen any mention in the secondary literature on this particular synchronicity. For her part, Abi Gray preferred to map her tastes in art onto an apolitical and distant Orient, aligning Iran and India in a single exhibition and mounting what would be one of the foundation's final and most comprehensive presentation of the Gray collection under the title 1001, One World Through Art. The reference, of course, being to 1001 Nights, as well as the number of works included in the exhibition. In addition to sharing an evolving geographic focus, it's fair to say that the foundation's promotion of communication through art and its tendency to conflate the collective and the individual echoed State Department policies towards the arts. The foundation's first initiative, a small exhibition of works by artists from Minnesota, was supported by the USIA's People-to-People program, established in 1956, and guided by Dwight D. Eisenhower's maxim that, quote, peaceful relations between nations require understanding and mutual respect between individuals. In what was probably an unintended echoing of similar phraseology, another undated progress report by the foundation reflected on its traveling exhibitions initiative. writing, quote, "It was found the personal touch of an American traveling with the exhibits, as Mrs. Gray did, adds a person-to-person touch to such programs." If art was a universal language, it nevertheless benefited from its attachment to various individuals who offered their services as charismatic dragomen. Ultimately, this would be Abby Gray's final word on her role, stating at the inaugural exhibition of NYU's Gray Art Gallery and Study Center, which was the recipient of most of her collection, in 1975, quote, "I am not an art collector in the usual sense, but rather have tried to improve communication among the world's people through art. I have been especially interested in the break from traditional art forms," unquote. The figure publicly tipped to play such a role was not, however, the patron or collector, but the artist. The same report asserts, "As contact has been made with artists of other countries, it has become apparent the world speaks one language at its roots. The artist is the international interpreter," unquote. The foundation found a gifted and energetic artist to take on this role in the figure of Iranian artist Parviz Tanavoli, who's seen at the center of this photo on the left, and this is a work of his on the right. This is actually the first moment of their encounter, according to Tanavoli's recollections, and after having met, she met Parviz, they went together and she visited his studio and acquired this work, so the first work of his on the right. Sorry. Gray was a major supporter of Tanavoli's work, as reflected in his stature within her collection, almost 80 works, just by Tanavoli, which is now housed at the Gray Art Gallery in NYU. In 1962, the foundation provided Tanavoli with a six-month grant to attend the Minneapolis School of Art, now MCAD, as a visiting artist. He would go on to extend his stay for 2 years as a staff member at the same institution. After Tanavoli returned to Iran, Gray provided funds to establish a bronze foundry at the University of Tehran, inaugurated in 1967. And here you see Mrs. Gray visiting the University of Tehran and a sort of suspicious-looking live model. There's a nice series of photos from that event. For his part, oh, here's another photo. This is Parviz Tanavoli at the same event speaking to Empress Farah Diba, who attended the event, thereby giving official blessing and sanction. For his part, Tanavoli connected Abby Gray to contemporary artists in Iran on her almost annual, here's another of those photos, Abby Gray to artists in Iran on her almost annual visits to the country. Sorry. And here you can see, I thought these were pretty interesting. These are photographs of Abby Gray and Parviz visiting another close friend and artist, Farmaz Hilaram, in his studio. And she actually acquires some works that are in the collection on this visit to the studio. So Tanavoli contributed actively to the Gray Foundation's exhibition program, and back in Iran, Shiva Balahi, the art historian, reports, he, quote, "helped organize a seminar on contemporary Iranian art at the Iran-American Society," which we've heard of before. During his Minnesota sojourn, Tanavoli organized an important exhibition titled 14 Contemporary Artists, 14 Contemporary Iranians, that toured the U.S. for 3 years under the auspices of the Western Association of Art Museums. At the time, it was celebrated as the first exhibition of its kind. In this period, he also served as an interpreter of the exhibition and its featured work to American audiences. Media reports of his lectures present the young artist in the role of cultural foil rather than critic or art historian. That is, his ekphrastic skills were deployed as much in service of elucidating Persian culture and identity or personality as the works on view. In a lecture titled My Country and Its Culture, accompanying 14 contemporary Iranians, Tanavali, quote, demonstrated how the older style in Persian painting is mixed with the latest symbols in painting to produce contemporary Iranian painting. The symbols of his people's myths are found as an influence in his own work, unquote. In addition to pointing out his magpie-like interest in borrowing from an eclectic range of motifs and material, both historic and contemporary to Iran, Tanavali also annexed well-established art historical tropes in making his work legible as Iranian or Persian to an American audience. So here he is in the role of the interpreter. Each of these tropes circle around a sweeping assertion of Bilder Verbot, or the so-called religious sanction against the figurative in Islamic art. An article covering the same event entitled Young Iranian Artist Explains Works Shown at Art Center reported that Tanavali explained the reason figures were not incorporated in early Persian art was because it was considered sacrilegious to produce a living form. The article continued, Tanavali pointed out that traditionally Iranian art has no perspective and has a flat look. This, he said, made it difficult to create a three-dimensional effect when he studied sculpturing in Italy. Keep in mind, Tanavali is a sculptor in three dimensions. Islamic art's anti-naturalistic and anti-academic qualities, so ascribed, positioned its latter-day practitioners onto a terrain shared with American and European modernists, without ceding any ground to cultural authenticity, and without threatening the boogeyman of the derivative. Quote, Tanavali explained, that the Persian artist, particularly of the past, painted what he saw in his mind rather than what he saw with his eyes, unquote. Tanavali would reiterate a similar sentiment in a 1968 interview with the Tehran Journal, equating the Persian artist with the philosopher and poet. And these figures of the philosopher and poet crop up again and again in his work as avatars for his own, for himself and his own practice. He said, Greek sculpture is the basis of classical Western art and Western philosophy. And it is quite different from Persian art and Persian philosophy. We have always been idealizers, poets. We never copy exactly, but always embellish with poetry and imagination. A tree done by a Persian artist or miniaturist is not a natural tree. It is both more and less than a tree, always the most perfect and above realism. So while the phrase seeing with the mind's eye might conjure a Platonic idealism, what's at stake is rather an idealism mediated by imagination, capable of rendering both more and less, as he says, than Western naturalism. And this is what defines Tanavali's understanding of a special Persian purchase on artistic modernism. In a recent essay titled Picasso the Muslim, or How Bilder Verbot Became Modern, Part 1, Islamic art historian Barry Flood traces a series of commentaries by art historians in Europe and the Middle East. This conversation, it's important to point out, is not just happening in Europe or by European art historians, it's also taking place in the Middle East, linking Islamic art's aniconism to avant-garde abstraction. Allow me a longish quote from Flood's article. The standard analogy between modern abstraction and the perceived flatness, two-dimensionality, anti-sculptural qualities, and rejection of naturalism in Byzantine and Islamic art was reiterated in the 1940s and would be famously taken up by Clement Greenberg in 1958, writing of such artists as Barnett Newman and Mark Rothko. By the middle of the 20th century, the interrelations between pre-modern and modern art imbued the experience of both with something akin to intertextuality or intervisuality. The valorization of the perceived abstract qualities of Islamic art was part of a broader 20th century phenomenon in which the experience of abstraction constituted a period taste characterized by a feedback loop. Reception of late antique, medieval, and pre-modern Islamic art as arts of abstraction was informed by a 20th century vogue for abstraction, which was in turn sometimes informed by the experience of pre-modern art. Not unpredictably then, the slipperiness of Islamic and modernist abstractions and the former's weird ability to be claimed as derivative despite its historical precedence worked its way into a review of 14 contemporary Iranians, the exhibition organized by Tanavali, with one critic observing, quote, 43 works, watercolors, drawings, and some oils reveal intriguing contrasts of the medieval, richly figured type of Muslim art with works definitely inspired by the cubism of Picasso. So this is a work, just to describe what you're seeing, this is a sculpture of Tanavali's, which has been backed against a Persian rug, and this is at the 1001 One World Through Art exhibition that took place in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And it's important because Tanavali continued to court an intertextual or intervisual, to borrow Flood's words, understanding of his work when he staged one of his sculptures, as I said, against the backdrop of a Persian carpet, effectively fusing the two into a hybrid work wherein the visual signifiers of Islamic and modern could be applied, in a sense, interchangeably to figure and ground. 1001 One World Through Art, in which the work was mounted and which Tanavali helped to install, also includes a special section devoted to the traditional arts of Islam. And here we have some photos of this, especially the top two strips. The voiceover for a 1970 film, which the Gray Foundation was involved in, titled Poet Philosopher, Revival of Bronze Casting in Iran, featuring Tanavali, and celebrating the foundation's gift of a foundry to the University of Tehran, adopted a similar script. That is, a script of intervisuality and intertextuality. So this is a shot from the literal script, People in the Park. Since the revival of bronze casting, the foundry has been commissioned by the Iranian government to execute sculptures for numerous garden and public areas. And then against Crown Prince shot, in another park, the Crown Prince of Iran plays with his friends. So this is the moment where I think you're starting to see on the horizon the way in which the Gray Foundation and Abby Gray's relationship to Parviz Tanavali and his particular thinking of what he's doing and how to make that legible to different audiences, we start to add this other central element, which is the role of the Iranian state and the imperial family in promoting the arts. Here's another couple of shots, and this is Parviz, and it looks like, I mean, I'm just speculating, but this looks like this is a public sculpture that is being installed, still hasn't been fully uncovered, and you have some of details of the surrounds and the people walking around. So the image, the juxtaposition of new bronze sculptures produced at the Gray Bronze Foundry and adorning public spaces in Tehran and the footage of the Iranian Crown Prince helped the viewers to identify the imperial family as the leading patron of contemporary art in Iran, as well as to suggest a reciprocal relationship between the two, with new Iranian art serving as a foil for the young Iranian empire. Tanavali is considered a key figure, if not co-founder, of Iran's celebrated Sakhakhane school, active in the 1960s and 70s, which figured centrally in this broader state-led initiative. The architect of the Tehran Museum of Contemporary Art, who happened to be the empress's cousin, Kamran Diba, quipped that Sakhakhane represented a form of spiritual pop art, claiming there is a parallel between Sakhakhane and pop art. If we simplify pop art, as an art movement which looks at the symbols and tools of a mass consumer society as a relevant and influencing cultural force. Sakakhane artists looked at the inner beliefs and popular symbols that were part of the religion and culture of Iran and perhaps consumed them in the consumed in the same way as industrial products in the West. I just wanted to show a picture of a sakakhane. This is the reference here would be to this kind of structure. This is a water fountain with connections to the story of Karbala and Shia religious practice and belief. Often there's the distinguishing characteristics to note, I think, would be the colors, the combination of colors, the grill, the presence of water. At times people would go and put locks on the grill as a way of making wishes or sort of submitting prayers. So it was I think this was absolutely characteristic of the kind of folk vernacular material visual culture that artists associated with the Sakakhane school were said to be interested in and were drawing upon for their own work. Diba's description of the Sakakhane school as producing spiritual pop art seems especially apt in application to Tanavali's Tanavali's scrap heap sculptures combining what he called traditional materials such as copper vessels, rugs, and calligraphy, along with such Western imports as plastics, fluorescent lights, and basic electric equipment, he explains. This is the work that you saw up against the Persian carpet in the One World exhibition. Hossein Zendarudi, another artist from the group, produced hallucinatory sherbet-colored canvases incorporating motifs from Shia material and visual culture, and also these definitely critically contributed to the development of a loosely defined aesthetic of the school. Perhaps surprisingly, it was this aesthetic that was promoted domestically and internationally by the state and by the ruling family as the preferred visual idiom for a new Iranian identity. So, and this, you know, sort of initiative was certainly not least served through the efforts of Abby Gray. I think it's important to point out, and some, as Hamid Yousafi has, an art historian, that these artists' adoption, interest in gathering folk and material culture, which interestingly is always in these conversations cited as being in southern Tehran. Southern Tehran is the location of the bazaar, which plays a very important, powerful political role, and ultimately in giving rise to the 79 revolution, but also is seen as the seat of authentic Iranian, sort of a class-inflected popular culture. So Yousafi says, you know, they drew their raw material from working class neighborhoods, but did not incorporate urban proletariat as active participants, instead reducing this vernacular culture to a set of decontextualized symbols utilized in the service of state ideology in the aftermath of the 1953 coup. So in a sense, they're incorporating materials and objects that are associated with the most politically volatile part of the city and its populace, but when it enters their works of art, these become a new visual idiom for the state and the Shah. I'm going to go back to Mohammad Riza. These are two paintings, speaking of pop art, by Andy Warhol of commissioned of the Shah and Shah Banu. There's a third one of the Shah's twin sister. Apparently he was instructed not to put that pink lipstick on the Shah, which is why he looks a little more subdued than some of the others. But I think he sort of fancied himself the, you know, Andy Warhol, the official portraitist of the Iranian imperial family. So we know there were some connections with pop art and what was happening in Iran. Mohammad Reza Pahlavi returned to power in the wake of a U.S.-backed coup in 1953 that deposed Prime Minister Mossadegh, as you know. The Shah's subsequent white revolution initiated large-scale infrastructure and industry development projects, education reform, and redistribution of agricultural land. The promotion of arts and culture represented another important plank of the Shah's program for reform. In 1971, this might also be a familiar image, the Shah hosted 69 dignitaries and royals from around the world in a lavish celebration of the 2,500th anniversary of the founding of the Achaemenid Empire by Cyrus the Great. The broader project was framed as a revival of past glory in the modern age. Imperial portrait painters would not suffice, and I just wanted to add this one, which I, because I love this image so much. These are three busts of the imperial family by Shahrukh Shahbazi. But what was required was a truly modernist art form that could be embraced by the state. If the Cold War exhibition was a medium, in Davidson's words, it functioned for the Gray Foundation in particular as a medium of communication. And yet the works compromising the foundation exhibitions devoted to Iranian artists appear to be speaking multiple languages. Tanavali's celebration of a poetic or philosophical abstraction, his protestations of innocence with regard to a naturalist Western tradition, were buoyed on the one hand by an exhibition medium that relied on his role as interpreter and the inclusion within the work and without of Iranian traditional and religious art and material culture. A closer look, however, at this Persian telephone, as it was called, and one immediately begins to suspect that there's something suspiciously erotic, and not only figurative, but phallically so, about the enterprise. This, similarly, the Gray Art Gallery website quotes Fereshte Daftari on another of Tanavali's work in the collection, this one. "We are happily locked within holes" evokes a cage or prison tower and invites the viewer to form a hybrid language that converts a prison into a temple of love, unquote. Here, the website continues in a slightly more forthcoming tone. Tanavali encourages the observer to look beyond the surface into confined spaces where sexuality and love clandestinely survive in the form of a phallus in one cell and interlaced hands in another. Indeed, often Tanavali's bid for a Persian abstraction that is legible to his American and Iranian audiences and patron serves as much to obscure the lead as to give insight into the work. Humor and eroticism abound in his practice, and his self-declared struggles to master the Western tradition of figurative sculpture quickly give way to an abundance of gendered bodies that should be understood, I would argue, as irreverent to many of these projects that have implications in this history I've been describing. An army scrap heap of robots flaunting oversized or half-hidden phalluses, breasts, and vaginas is probably not what the Shah saw when he was looking at Sakakhane art as an idiom for his rule. This approach is not specific to Parviz. The work of Farmaz Pilaram also plays with a kind of the way in which abstraction can be used to hide a certain transgressive bodily presence. So he would produce these watercolors with ink and mixed media that evoke the symbols of Shia religious culture, or also mosques, but also look like interlocking bodies. And if you start to think about, you know, this sacred symbol of the hand of Abbas forming two breasts, it becomes a very charged sort of work with a very different kind of set of stakes. And yet it's easily read as an abstraction of Islamic motifs. This is another even more explicit version. I'm just going to close with, I think, what I take away from this research so far, which is the Sakakhane group, and it's a very diverse group doing many different things, was described as neo-traditional. I would say that they are synthetic versus binary in the face of Cold War politics. This approach relies on a shifting series of occlusions that not only undermines the Cold War sort of framework, but is also echoing it. So, you know, we have that, as someone said yesterday, this kind of Orwellian emptying of language, and one word becomes another thing. There's a shifting and slippage that happens that is going on in this work as well. And I believe that, what gets pointed out is also the dependency of this visibility or legibility that was at the core of Abby Gray's project, dependency of that on occlusions or on blind spots and on not being able to see certain things at certain times or only being able to see certain things at certain times at the expense of others. So there's a chain of substitutions in what I've been talking about. You have the conflation of the role of the artist as interpreter and as a collector himself of folk art and traditional art, affects the occlusion of the craftsman who's producing those works, or the space of political political resistance, and replaces it with this figurehead of a publicly sanctioned art form. This is what also Hamid Yousafi would describe as the substitution of identity politics for political reform, or freedom, if we're going to use that word, and the individual for the collective again. In the case of Abby Gray, you have her standing in for the state, and you have Parviz standing in for Abby Gray. So there's a series of stand-ins. There's also a dynamic of simultaneity, which is a tactical move that draws on an already existing history that's not very well known of drawing connections between Islamic art and modernist abstraction. And I like to think about this as the intertextuality or intervisuality of the work. Two things exist at once. You can see one, you can see the other. It's very hard to see all of them at the same time. There's a political necessity to that. You're evading censorship. You're doing what you want, but at the same time, you're presenting something that's legible in the terms that will allow you to, do what you want. Every evocation, every reference is a disavowal that is in turn disavowed. And I think that's really the end of my talk. this Orwellian play of substitutions. Thank you.